This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest writer, director, Finn Taylor. How are you, Finn?
Great, man. How are you doing, Rich?
Doing well. Thanks for being on the show today.
I'm excited.
Yeah, Finn Taylor is a writer and director known for the films Dream with the Fishes, the Darwin Awards, and Cherish. You know, Finn, since this show is called Poet Escape, and since you're not only a filmmaker but also a great appreciator of poetry, I thought it might be apt to begin today's show by having you talk a little about your thoughts on the parallels between film and poetry.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I started out writing poetry, and my last working gig before getting into film, I was a literary director at a place called Intersections of the Arts up in San Francisco, which is an interdisciplinary arts place. It's been around for 30 to 40 years. Whoopi Goldberg got her start there. They have a theater, a literary program, and an arts program. And, I was really immersed in poetry and performance art. And at least the poetry I was getting into, I was very into language poetry. And I you probably know this, Rich. Sometimes when you're following a certain path, you feel like, wow, I've got to be going towards the point of the needle, you know, if I'm exploring. And so, in a sense, for me anyway, my focus was narrowing, and probably the people I was speaking to was narrowing.
Yeah.
And I thought, am I really serving this way? But it was also a time, you know, when I was younger, and whatever came to be, I just wrote it. I remember I wrote a love letter, and I tried making a poem out of it. It didn't work. Tried making a short story out of it. It didn't work. So finally, I made it into a screenplay. And it really occurred to me, you know, we often think of film being analogous to novels. In fact, they're so different because the basis of many novels, you're kind of in the interior of the mind of the character and his musings. In film, really, what it's about are poetic images done in a very specific structure, much like in poetry, you have a villanelle or a haiku or a sonnet, and that's how you communicate. You don't really communicate so much by the internal musings of the novel. And, you know, the more you get into film and screenwriting, the more you realize, well, this is really like writing, you know, a book of haikus or a book of sonnets, a very, very specific structure.
Right.
And you have to communicate. If you think of, you know, even, let's say, mainstream film, your favorite film, you know, you're going to, let's say, you think of Shawshank Redemption, you're going to remember the moment him standing out in the rain or him listening to opera in the office. There are little weird moments, or the guy looking for the geode in the field, Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, there's that distillation of detail where, you know, really fine poetry has that distillation of detail, and like what you're talking about with really fine films as well, you remember those moments and those details.
Yeah, and the other thing with film is brevity. When it comes to dialogue or even image, if you look at a scene, it's just a few words communicating what's going on, if there is dialogue at all. And whereas in poem, you know, within a novel, you can have a many pages kind of monologue going on, going through the musings. In film, you really can't do that. It's this moment. You know, how is this one poetic image going to tell the story, or one phrase held up against the image? And if you go back and think of it, can be any spec. It can even be in documentary sometimes. But really, in narrative, it's any of your favorite films. When you go down, you're going to think, oh, I think of this moment or that moment. And it kind of, there's five or six of those that represent a whole film in your memory generally. Kind of much, even like with a Shakespeare sonnet or a great poem, you'll remember that one line or two, you know, that strikes you and takes you back to that place.
Yeah. Do you have that sort of experience for your own films? I mean, when you look back at the films you've made so far, do you have that kind of thing where you sort of, there are just certain moments within each film that really strike you?
Well, I would say, you know, of course, often sometimes, you know, we think, oh, I should have done this differently or that differently. But certainly, you know, because a film is such an expensive medium and you get so close to it, literally you work on, you know, I think the shortest it's taken me to do a film is 3 years, and more often it's 5-6 years. You screen it many times, and you definitely recognize the few moments that resonate with most people. And very often they're the ones, what I notice is the ones that resonate most with other people are inspired or directly lifted from very personal, embarrassing moments. You know, like the most you expose yourself, the most honest you are, no matter what, it doesn't matter what your budget is, people respond to the smallest, most personal moments. Yeah, I mean, Dream of the Fishes was a semi-autobiographical film, and people remember the moments, you know, like, you know, there's a scene where he holds up a drugstore, which was kind of based on a, you know, a real moment in my life, and another one on the bridge, and those are the ones people remember. But even in films which are more flights of fancy, like in the Darwin Awards, you have all these giant stunt sequences. I mean, it was a very expensive film for me, you know, it was like a $9 million film or something.
Right.
And they responded to little moments like in the shower or this moment with a cell phone, which were more inspired by awkward moments in my life. And those got the biggest laughs and reaction. So I think, like, the recurring lesson that we all learn in creative works is the more you're willing to be, you know, expose yourself,
Now that you've sort of discovered that for yourself, do you find that when you're working on a new screenplay or something that you try to infuse the work with more moments like that?
I think, for instance, I think, you know, as a writer, it's sort of, first off, it's kind of out of your control, right?
Sure.
It's coming through you and moving from the top of your head to the fingertips onto the keyboard, right? But having said that, been working for a long time in this movie about Bill Monroe, who's a man who, you know, sort of invented bluegrass music. And, I read enough. There's a book called Can't You Hear Me Calling that I read and talked to enough people that I saw kind of this common theme in his life, you know, this terror of being abandoned, this attachment to women. He lost his mother at a young age, and this one passionate love affair. And all his songs are kind of about that. You know, they're kind of like, he had a girlfriend that, Bessie Lee Malden, they had a long time sort of dysfunctional love affair, and they would get in a fight, and she would simply move across the country.
Wow.
Now, in the 1940s, there's no cell phone or internet. You'll never find that person again. You know, you would have no way of doing it. So he would write a very specific song, lyrics like, Can't You Hear Me Calling? You know, it was all my fault the night we broke up. Please, you know, call me. It's my request, you know. And he would get the record company to put it out within a month. And she would hear it, and she would come back to him over and over again.
Wow.
And it became, you know, he sort of, aside from inventing bluegrass music, Hank Williams was a big fan of his, but Bill and Hank were sort of credited with making country songs story songs, or true life songs, as Bill called them. And when I was looking for a structure for this film, he has a film, he has a song, Letter to My Darling, where, you know, there's a letter and there's no return address, and he's trying to from his darling, and there's no return address, and he's trying to find her. So I use that as a kind of a structure in the film where he's got this letter from Bessie Lee, and it has the beginning of a street address, but she doesn't leave the city, and there's no postal mark on it. So he's trying to find her in a town called Lynchburg, but there's Lynchburgs in like four different states.
Right.
And he's going from state to state to try and find her. So I tried to, and the other thing I did, I tried to find the most, we all have a personal story. So with him, I tried to say, what's his personal story? And he has one song that I tripped upon that's, I think, the most beautiful song he ever wrote. And he never recorded it. He gave it to the famous woman duo Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's his whole life with women. It was about, oh, getting them back or having them stay with him. And because he had this kind of whole inside from when his mother died. And in this one song, he says, okay, I'll let you go. You know, I'll try to let you be, you know. And I think part of the reason he never recorded it is it was too close to home. Because, you know, that's what he ultimately needed to learn, I think, as a person, was to, the higher love is to let somebody go if they need to leave rather than trying to get them back over and over again.
Right.
And, so I used that at the end of the film. And I actually have him sing it. I know he's performed it, but he never recorded it. So I have his character perform it at the end of the movie. So I, even though it's not my life, in exploring the character, I try to find, you know, what is their most vulnerable, you know, personal truth that I can glean from this? You know, of course, all in my interpretation, right? But so that is a form of exposing oneself, you know? So I even if it's not directly from my life, I try to think, well, what was their thing? What was their moment? And yes, of course, when anything where my life is relevant, I try to do it. I think with film of any kind, you know, feature, I'm talking about feature films that you go see in
sure.
the theater. Part of the job of it at its best, when you're not just entertaining, is to kind of reach out to the existential void and tap another human on the shoulder and say, yeah, you're not alone. You know, we're all a little fucked up. We're all vulnerable. We all mess up at times. We're all, you know, flawed. And I think that's kind of, you know, in a nutshell what you're trying to achieve. And I felt that about poetry as well. I feel that about poetry.
Yeah. You know, while on the topic of the Bill Monroe film, Peter Sarsgaard's involved with that, right?
Well, there's a long story.
Okay.
Peter was at one point, but now Michael Shannon in Boardwalk Empire is going to play Bill Monroe.
Oh, okay.
And Take Shelter, and we recorded some amazing music for it and cast the film, and we were still raising a few of the remaining funds, but we've recorded 70 songs. You know, not all of them will appear in their entirety in the film, but amazing musicians like Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys and Jim James from My Morning Jacket, and a lot of the greats like Ralph Stanley recorded for it, Earl Scruggs, and contemporary musicians like Patti Loveless and Dierks Bentley and Ted Moe. And
is T-Bone Burnett involved with it, or?
Well, he was at one point.
Uh-huh. Right.
But the music at this point is recorded, and you know, with film, for certain reasons, I have to dance around certain issues. But basically, Ronnie McCurry, who is in the band, the Dale McCurry Band, and an amazing musician, has done so much great work on the film and is an amazing music producer. And, you know, we have other bands like Old Crow Medicine Show who recorded for it. And just everybody wanted to be involved in the life story of Bill Monroe and his music.
You know, something.
So,
something you said earlier, and something that just crossed my mind now as you were talking about this. You said earlier, you know, the shortest amount of time you worked on a film was 3 years. You know, film, I think, is one of those mediums that can take. You know, when you look at it compared to music or just, you know, writing, you know, poetry or fiction or whatever.
Right.
Film is an epic project that involves so many people, and you know. As you've said, it can take years. I mean, how are you able to keep your focus and direction with a film that, you know, is spanning over a number of years?
Yeah, you know, it's challenging. And, you know, when I talk to kids at, you know, colleges or high school, and they say they want to be filmmakers, and I ask them why. And I think if you have a story you're burning to tell, You know, how I was saying earlier is like, you can't really choose it. It sort of chooses me. And the reason I think that for that, or for me anyway, is it better be burned into your soul. And you must feel it's like a quest to get it out. Otherwise, you would never have the stamina to do it. You know, you couldn't, I don't think you could artificially generate the stamina required, at least to do things, you know, kind of independently the way they're done for the most part these days. You know, unless you're doing a big action movie. So it's kind of, and in a way, and sometimes I feel this way with poetry too, you have to firmly be able to visualize the finished product, the outcome. And it's almost that it's already in existence. Now, the shape of it may change in the journey getting there, but you almost have to visualize that it is here, or its intention is that it needs to be here, and you've been given the quest of manifesting it. And it's got to, it's, for me anyway, I know it sounds corny to talk about it in those ways, but it actually has to feel like that. And it's definitely been problematic on my relationships. You know, I think my record for a romantic relationship is 4 years, you know. And there's always some point I was engaged to somebody where, you know, it's just, it's sort of such a manic quest that it takes up a lot of room.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's definitely there, but I think it's probably, you know, like, I don't know if you have that when you're writing songs where you can almost glimpse the finished thing even before you've written it, or it's to exist. But it's that same process, but, it's just got to fuel you, with enough energy to last that long, because yes, ultimately you're going to involve a lot of people, even before it's made. I mean, we've already involved probably 100 people in this film at this point. And, you know, there will be hundreds more before it's done. You've got to feel it's a very worthy, a worthy gesture.
Yeah.
You know?
So you've been doing this for a little while now, since the 90s or whatever. I'm curious, have there been anything, either with the way media is changing or whatever, the way... some differences in the way you have to approach making films these days?
Oh, yeah. The internet changed things. Without getting on a political soapbox, and it's changed things in music too. There was a time up through the early 2000s, let's say, if you really busted your ass and made a really, you know, if you worked on the script for years, got a good cast, and made a film, you know, that got into, let's say, Sundance and was one of the sort of favorites there, you could probably sell the broadcast television rights and the DVD rights and foreign rights enough to break even or make a slight profit for the people who invested in the film. Well, the internet radically changed that. First, it was piracy that started to change that, where people, you know, were doing, ripper programs to illegally copy DVDs, and then, you know, more on the internet. And so what happened was companies would say, well, we're not going to buy it for what we used to buy it for. We'll buy it for a dime and make whatever we can off of it. So that kind of made, you know, it's kind of like with songs on the internet. What changed is you're not going to make anything off your intellectual property. And maybe with a musician, what you can do is make money off your touring and use the record on the internet as a way of advertising your music.
Right.
But and the other analogy I noticed, you know, so I'll say what the negative parts are, and then I think there are positives too. The negative parts are, in the old days, much like with news, you used to have real newspapers, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, where you could afford to have journalists who had spent years studying their craft and had a budget to investigate their story. And it was actually a very important part of our political process, like Woodward and Bernstein taking down Nixon. Now that's been replaced essentially with blogs, with people without, you know, without the training or the money or the budget to thoroughly investigate something in a way and having a, an individual avenue to wield enough power to keep the politics in check. So it's sort of fractionalized us. And I'd say in the same way, there are no longer, you know, you remember in the days when the great albums were being created, you know, and there were budgets to create, you know, to go into the studio and create an epic album. That no longer exists.
Yeah.
So on the positive note, there is kind of more of a meritocracy building. The problem is, finding ways for it to get heard or seen that flows uphill, that can be discovered, you know, because you no longer have the big budget to launch it in a campaign. Occasionally there is something where the merit is so good. I was on this board for this great foundation, Upfield Uranium Foundation, where we funded Free Fail Station, the Ryan Coogler film.
Oh, yeah.
And I was lucky to be on the three-person board where we were, you know, one of the times they give different rounds of, and his, you know, I remember just seeing the first 10 pages of the script and a little bit of one of his short films, and I said, well, this is so brilliant and relevant. This is definitely going to pierce through the void and touch people, and we all felt that way. I was just one of the people there, and that with the help of a lot of powerful people, found an audience, somewhat of an, I think it should have had an even bigger audience, but it had a lot of very powerful allies. So that has all changed things. So I think with film, you've got to still be being driven by your passion and be ever more creative and innovative in the way that you fund it and the way you get it out there. So it's a lot more challenging for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm excited by the changes in technology, seeing that, when I talk to kids in college and high school, they are intimately, aware of all the details of things like iMovie or Final Cut Pro and how to use a video camera. And they know a million times more than I did at their age, or most of us did, about all of that. The one area where they are lacking in motivation and knowledge is writing, unfortunately. And with film, in the end, it's the screenplay that's going to determine how good your film is.
Yeah, you know? The story. What story do you have to tell? Yeah.
Yeah, and how to tell it. And there's many good things coming in, some new challenges. So, that's what I noticed. And you probably noticed that as a performer. I mean, in a way, what's great is I can see the videos of your stuff on YouTube, and I delight seeing that. So it gives new opportunity, too.
Yeah.
It's just thinking, and you got to be flexible in how you, as an artist or craft person, I always call film craft, adapt to that. I really piss people off when I say, well, I kind of think of film as craft more than art. People are insulted by that, and I don't mean it at all as an insult, but, you know, a screenplay structure is like a piece of furniture. It's often said, you know, with a chair, you need at least three legs for it to stand, and it's much the same for a screenplay and the acts. And then you require, large groups of people in unions to crank it out. You know, and when people protest that, I think, well, look at visual art, the radical changes it goes through. In film for the past 100 years, I'm talking about film you pay to see in the theater, you follow around either one or a few different protagonists for 90 to 120 minutes, and you go through very specific plot points. It's not like the screen turns blue for 10 minutes. It's a very specific form, and I don't think there's anything wrong with craft. I really regard craft highly, but I do see that as different than art, where, you know, a major artist can completely change the form of it in 1 or 2 years, and the trend of art, it doesn't really happen that way with film. Film is a giant tanker that turns very slowly.
Right. You were talking about story just before, and this question crossed my mind because, I've had this challenge at times where there's a story that I want to tell, and I hit it from one angle, and I think that's the angle to hit it from, and I start telling the story from that point. And then at a certain point, I realize, no, I'm coming at it from the wrong direction. I need to hit it from another side. Do you ever have that with when writing a screenplay? You know you have a story to tell, but you maybe have, it takes you some time to figure out the way to actually approach telling that story, how to enter it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, for those listeners out there, Rich and I were friends in Los Angeles when we were all sort of, at the dawn or the mid-morning of whatever our pursuits were. And so there were musicians and writers,
Jeremy
and
Toback,
actors.
Who's been on Poet Escape.
Yeah, Jeremy Toback, my dear friend. And I think the greatest thing about that for me at that time and for life is just remaining open. Even though I talk about, well, you know, film is this rigid form, you know, and I've used some of Jeremy's songs in my films, I just remaining open. I think that's another big job of a craftsperson or artist. So I had this one script, Cherish, which was inspired by friends who had been on a house arrest with an electronic bracelet and some of the specific stories they told. And I was imagining a story. I also had another friend with threats. I was imagining, originally I was writing it with in mind the idea, story of a homeless man with Tourette's who, when he lets his guard down, he goes on medication and tries to join normal society, breaks, you know, gets caught in a crime, not really to his fault, and gets into house arrest. And it was kind of a much more of a straightforward noir or thriller. And then I was on a drive to visit my cousin up in Oregon. She was staying at an ashram or something. And it was a long, circuitous route, and I love road trips. And I was just listening to these AM and FM radio stations that were playing like love songs, one after the other. And I started listening to the lyrics, and I was thinking, well, these are kind of creepy, you know. This song, Cherish, is the word I used to describe if I could hold you or mold you into someone that would love me as much as I love you, you know, kind of really intense, obsessive lyrics. And I thought, there's something here. So I completely changed the approach. And I said, well, if I'm going to tell this story about house arrest, what if I, you know, I was thinking about these pop songs. I'm kind of imprisoned by the pop songs by the end of the trip because they have a hook that won't let you go. And while you're laughing at them, they've firmly hooked themselves into your medulla oblongata, and they're there in your memory forever, right? And so I made it a woman character who was obsessed with this radio station that played love songs all the time. And I used that as the method for how she originally gets into trouble and her one of her main connections to the outside world when she's on house arrest. So it completely changed it for me, and it was able to help me make that movie into more of a meditation on pop music, kind of a postmodern look at pop music and film. And I think the film was much better for it, you know. And it was just, you know, I knew I wanted this story about house arrest, but just remaining open to the environment and what was going on around me at the time. And so Cherish has a soundtrack of like 60s, 70s, and 80s obsessive love songs, you know, and is kind of the center of the film.
I mean, you've got Soft Cell, Modern English, Tom Petty. I mean, the list goes on and on as far as like...
Yes, of course. Yeah, it does. And you know, it changed the dialogue of the script where clearly that's what was going on. And I had her in the beginning sort of obsessively imagining about a guy. And when she would imagine him, she would see, you know, like music video images. And then when another guy starts to fantasize about her, he does the same, and even a third character. So I kind of got into the heads of the characters and had their imaginings about the other people play out like a music video, using music video iconography and tricks, you know. So that really became the center of the film. And it was kind of just as you say, taking the same story and looking at it from a different angle. And I think with all the negatives of spending years writing a screenplay, the positives are you can, you know, give it time to you know, filter into what it's supposed to be, you know.
Yeah, and I love that, how you said before about being open and basically giving yourself the permission, as opposed to beating yourself up, giving yourself the permission to say, you know what, I should come at it from another way. I think it'll be a better film if I do that. Or, you know, you eventually discover that it will be a better film because of that.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody recently. She's teaching acting, and she's studying acting, and she's teaching acting on a postgraduate level. And we both said, you know, when you're talking to actors, and I realize this is true for everybody, it's like so much of the work is helping the person not beat themselves up and letting them be vulnerable, you know. And I remember once when I was in L.A. and I got my first big writing gig, you know, for pay, where I was doing writing somebody else's movie, and I found myself having some writer's block. And, you know, this is going to what you were saying about not beating yourself up. As corny as it sounds, I was going into therapy, and she said the best thing I ever, you know, got out of therapy, and I've never had writer's block ever since, but she said essentially, children are the ultimate survivors, and they're going to do whatever they need to get through childhood. And that method you use in childhood eventually will stop working for you. And you've got to find a way to reassign that. You got to really visualize what, and for me, it was a drill sergeant. In childhood, it was a drill sergeant that would beat me up, that would get me out of the house, that would get me to school on time, because my house was kind of like a total mess, and my family, who I loved dearly, was, you know, always 2 hours late to everything, and I had to not do that. So she said, you've got to be able to talk to that part of yourself and reassign it. And it's really true. You know, it's like once I did that and realized that, you know, it really set me free to write, you know. And I really think, you know, when you're a craftsperson or an artist, it's half the job, or maybe even two-thirds of the job, is finding a way to not beat yourself up and to remember to play.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. On that idea of being set free, and I love this story, and I'm hoping you can tell it for the listeners. And this kind of goes into the category, I would say, of one of those moments in life where you think your career path is going in one direction, only to find out later that it was a lesson to be learned to send you in a very different direction. But I was hoping you could tell the Pontiac Moon story and how that eventually led you to independent film and creating your own films.
Sure, I will. But as a preface to this, now that I'm older, I want to say I love all the people that worked on and made Pontiac Moon, and I'm grateful for the experience, and I got paid well, and it's, you know, I got an intro into the way, you know, Hollywood works, which has worked for many years. But having said that, you know, there's something I always say to people, oh, yeah, sold the first screenplay I ever wrote and got made into a $24 million movie. And then I say, you know, it only took me 6 years and 63 drafts, you know. So a great friend, still a great friend to this day, who finally just directed his first feature film, Jeff Brown. He won an Oscar for Best Dramatic Short back in the 80s. Just directed a great film. I got to plug this, called Sold, which is about human trafficking. And it's a narrative film. It's going to be at the L.A. Indian Film Festival coming up soon, and the Seattle Film Festival, and the London Indian Film Festival later this summer.
Great.
Anyway, had the plug. So Jeff saw one of my bizarre, off-the-wall plays, performance art play, South of Market, with a big cast and everything, said, do you have any screenplays? And I happened to. And he started to pay me to work on Pontiac Moon and rewrite it for many years, and with the intention of him directing it. And the way the studio system works, let us say that it got made, Jeff did not get to direct it, and a wonderful guy, Peter Maddock, directed it, but it was done through the studio system. And I, even though it was probably going in a direction where it became a bigger film than it should have, with, you know, a cast to justify the budget, and it was not sort of how I originally envisioned it, I wanted to stick around and do whatever I could. If I could make this line, you know, 10% better than it would be. And so I was there the whole time, the 4 months of shooting across five different states. You know, we shot in five states. And it was painful. It was kind of like, you know, when your child's in surgery, but you want to hold its hand, you know, even though it's a painful process. And, you know, there were a lot of, you know, it was the way I look at it now on a positive note, although I could see totally it was going in an extremely different direction than I had originally envisioned. I saw, well, this is how cameras work, and this is what this person's job is on the set, and what a cinematographer is, and what an assistant director is, And it also made me realize if I ever tell another person's story, which the next one was Dream of the Fishes, that just getting it made, you know, you think, oh, just getting it made is the most important thing, isn't necessarily the most important thing if it doesn't turn out the way you would like. And, you know, I'd say Pontiac Moon didn't turn out how I envisioned it, but I respectfully now think, well, that's the Hollywood system. And, you know, they did probably what they should have with it, but it's different than what I envisioned. So I ended up actually writing Dream of the Fishes with the intention, okay, Jeff, we're going to set this right, and you're going to get to direct this. And so, you know, we worked on the script for years, and we were casting, we had actors interested, and we were, like, pretty far along. And then Jeff had some personal issues going on in his life, and he realized, I can't direct this. And now at this point, I was totally out of money. I had a month's worth of money left, and I realized, well, my life has come down to the point where I need to direct this because I don't want someone else to do it. And I made it happen, and it was absolutely the right thing for me because that was sort of the experience I was hoping for, getting to direct it the way I had envisioned it when I wrote it. And I've gone on to direct a few other films, you know, since now. And so it was trying to take what was a very painful experience and learn from it and adapt with that. And, you know, instead of $24 million, I made Dream of this just like $1 million, and it ended up getting into Sundance. And we had 14 different studios negotiating for rights, including Paramount, who had made Pontiac Moon. And the head of Paramount got on the phone with me as they were trying to buy Dream of the Fishes and said, you know, Jeff should have been able to direct Pontiac Moon. You were writing all this stuff. And, you know, it was just an interesting thing to go full circle. But I learned from everybody on that film, all the actors, from Peter Medak, the director. And, you know, I learned a lot of good lessons on that film.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, instead of getting knocked down or destroyed by an experience, it's like, well, what can I learn from this? How is it going to inspire me for the next one?
Yeah. You know, I'm sure it must have been scary as hell to sort of step into those directing shoes in the very beginning. But what would you say, what qualities of yourself have sort of been called forth, or what characteristics or whatever have you had to develop over the years to make yourself a better director?
Really good question. Well, collaboration is always the key. Learning more. Well, how can I collaborate this way? And even, okay, here's the conundrum. Here's the real, this is the one. You need a lot of tenacity to get a film made, you know, and to have a whole crew listen to you and all of that. And yet you don't want to let that tenacity turn into stubbornness.
Yeah.
And you want to listen to your gut, and you want to have the tenacity and the forthrightness to get something, the important thing that you're looking for, into it, but you need to retain the flexibility to play. And I'll give an example. And sometimes, okay, here I'll tell the story.
Great.
In my, you know what I was talking about, you know, when I was writing poetry, you're kind of searching for the point of the needle. And, okay, I've been writing screenplays for years, which have a very set structure, and I was kind of liberated by that. A lot of certain writers said, you know what's great about the form of a villanelle or a sonnet or a haiku is it sets you free from the blank page to then be creative, you know. And there's a lot of truth in that. But by the time Darwin Awards came along, I thought, okay, well, how can I vary from the set structure? And there's an apocryphal nature to these stories, and how do I, how do I reflect that? So I would say structurally, I fucked with the beast, which the beast being the unrelenting structure of film, and I knew it was going to piss a lot of people off to do that. So, instead of just following the two main characters, you're going to follow the arc of the sub-character, which is a sort of a beast story, or a reflection of the whole main story, like the guy that attaches a rocket to his car, or
yeah,
the guys that want to break into the Metallica concert. So that was my, I guess you could say, my fatal mistake in a way, although that film's been seen by more people than all my other films combined. But, so in terms of flexibility, one day we're on the set, and I'm working with Judah Friedlander, who is Frank on the show, 30 Rock, great comedian. and Lucas Haas, who's in films like Brick and Witness, and a wonderful actor, and they're playing two avid Metallica fans. And we're on this, we're supposed to have a van pull up, their crappy van that is the character's van, and it breaks down, so we're delayed for 2 hours. So I go to Judah, who's playing Frank, and I said, let's come up with a separate story. How does he get out of his house? And I talk to the landlady who is loaning us the building or renting us the building to use in the scene. I said, hey, would you like to act in the scene? And I make her Frank's mother. And we come up with a sub-storyline, which is a great and got a good laugh in the film, because I sit down with the actors and let's improvise something, and because we don't have a van here yet. And it ended up, you know, a really funny moment in the film and informed the characters and made them deeper and, you know, sort of flexibility that allows you to collaborate more and more and be open to the moment so that your vision of what you need to get out creatively doesn't impede you from being flexible and open to the moment. Or, when I'm doing the scene with Metallica, I have a chance to, let's shoot this scene backstage where I can see them act a bit. And I end up using that in the end of the movie because one of the producers suggested it editorially, and I thought it worked great, you know. And I think what I learned the most is don't let your tenacity and your vision of what needs to happen in the end screw with your flexibility or your ability to collaborate, you know.
Yeah.
Find a way to make it less about yourself. You know, I don't mean in terms of vulnerability or what you're willing to share, but really you're only the portal, to be the portal. And it's a real dangerous game because you kind of have to be a taskmaster when you're making a film. But you really want to mainly be a portal to let magic happen, let play happen. And through friends of mine, I don't know him personally, I don't want to say this, but I have friends who know him, I found out one of my favorite directors, Terrence Malick, is a bit that way. Mm-hmm. And that was gratifying to hear. He's made some of my favorite films over the years. And, you know, not to say he never makes a mistake or is an error, but I also think he finds the most transcendent moments in contemporary film ever, you know. So that's kind of the ongoing lesson. It's like, how can I, you know, I'll cite a pop song, hang on loosely, but don't let go. If you cling too tightly, you're going to lose control.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
You know? I see it all around me, good love and gone bad.
Yeah. You know,
anyway.
I've seen it in Dream with the Fit. You know, I've seen this in a number of your films where you have flawed characters, but yet it's those flaws that hold the most appeal as opposed to just some sort of everyday likable Joe or whatever. How do you go about creating characters that fuck up, yet we as audience members are so drawn to them?
Well, I think, you know, there's a great screenwriter, Alvin Sargent. He wrote, among many things, one of them was Ordinary People, and he said, and this is another key with film, and I think it's true probably with music and poetry, is tone. Know what your tone is. And he had this scene in mind of a father driving home, the father played by Donald Sutherland, in his car, and he's in the garage door is closed, and he just doesn't want to get out of the car because he doesn't want to go home inside where no one's talking to each other. And he said, once I had that scene, I knew the tone for the rest of the movie. And even though that scene is maybe not the most memorable scene in the movie, it's probably the most memorable scene is like, take the goddamn picture when they're all supposed to take this family portrait, right? And so in Dream of the Fishes, I wanted to tell this story, which was kind of autobiographical, of helping a friend live out his fantasies in those last few weeks. And I felt that those characters that were so flawed and wanted to live out such banal fantasies had to be young. It would have been pathetic if they were older and had those fantasies.
Right?
So that's one thing. It's like, and you can excuse a lot when a character is young. And that was part of it. It's like, okay, I want them to be flawed. I want this guy to be kind of really never having stepped into life. And I want the other guy to be kind of like maybe usury, like to consume life so much to the point where he's usury and have them interact. And so knowing that was the tone, and when I looked at, you know, some of my favorite films from the 70s, I realized, you know, character has got to be very young to you know, allow him to go on such a journey or make such mistakes or kind of flail around so much, or perhaps very old, but in between wouldn't work. So when looking at actors, we had the options of a lot of actors. I realized, you know, they've got to stay sort of young. And even, you know, when I cast these at our set, I didn't cast him so much because of the roles he had done, although he was kind of, you know, kind of really coming, his career was kind of taking off at the point. It was more when I met him. And he himself is kind of, you know, kind of a very vulnerable, nervous, sweet guy. And what I saw in him as a person is what spoke to me about having him act in it. And it also, the other question we had is, at that point, we had a lot of options for, a lot of famous options to play the character of Nick. But I saw it, and my casting director, Joseph Middleton, who went on to cast, like, you know, all the Bourne Identity movies and lots of great movies, and that was kind of his first gig. He encouraged me to go with this unknown guy, Brad Hunt, who, while not famous, was so much right for the character, and we wouldn't come with the baggage of a more famous character. So you could really almost believe these guys were just real guys going through this together. And I think that, and again, you know, in terms of how do you get it, I think to just go back to yourself, to either yourself or people you know, people who are flawed in the ways they're flawed and why you accept them for their flaws and why you want to go. And the other thing is, if you don't have flaws, where do they evolve to? And I think that was part of what I learned from Pontiac Moon. The main character, they wanted to clean him up quite a bit because they didn't want him to be too distasteful or disliked. And I'm like, I don't know. I think some of the favorite characters in cinemas are kind of unlikable, you know, like, you know, Michael in Godfather, or when I think of, like, Tom Cruise, one of his better roles in Rain Man, he's an asshole.
Right.
You know, and you kind of want, you know, they have somewhere to go. If they're too likable, where do they have to go? Where do they have to evolve?
So
that's part of it, too. It's like, and you know, you want redemption, and it can be small redemption, but you want something to be redeemed. You know, they've got to be on some kind of a journey that they're not totally aware of.
Yeah.
So you
mentioned the 70s, going back to films mm-hmm. from the 70s, and I saw in an interview that you did, you were talking about some of your favorite films from the early 70s, like Harold and Maude and Midnight Cowboy, and how they almost had an indie feel to them. I'm curious
yeah.
if you could talk about some of those films and then perhaps where the change occurred in the film industry, where that sort of thing changed.
Yeah. Well, this is something that, like, a lot of filmmakers know about because it was, you know, I was a kid growing up, and I had my Aunt Ruth, that would take me to all the R-rated films when I was 10 or 11, and I'd see things like Midnight Cowboy, but essentially the 60s came along, and I think that one of the first big eye-openers for the industry was Easy Rider. So you had these guys go with very little money and go make this movie, and it made a ton of money, and they said, they were kind of like, well, we don't really understand what these kids are doing, so let's give them money and let them go. And you had directors like Hal Ashby, one of my favorite directors, who directed Harold and Maude and The Last Detail and great films like that, human-based films, that were given, they were getting funded by major studios. Robert Evans, you know, the kid stays in the picture, being one of the guys that funded a lot of these guys' films. And then you had you know, people like Coppola in his early films, like The Conversation. It was getting funded by studios, and these were kids fresh out of film school. And, you know, there was a much greater latitude, and you had films like Two Lane Blacktop and creating. My friend George Hickenlooper, who passed away a couple of years ago, you know, wrote about this in a lot of the interviews he did in Real Conversations. So you were having these extremely indie films by today's standards being funded by major studios. Films like, you know, even films like Vanishing Point and Tulane Blacktop and California Split and Cutter's Way and Harold and Maude. And they were kind of quirky and awkward and human-based stories. And it was partly because the studios didn't know what to do. They realized that the musicals from the 60s were no longer playing, cowboy westerns were no longer playing, and war movies were no longer playing. So they gave the reins over to the kids, you know, the Mavericks, the auteurs, and were kind of letting them do what they wanted to do. Bob Rafelson, Five Easy Pieces, you know, movies like that, and that were kind of giving a truer picture of the American landscape than anything before it, a very flawed American landscape. And what happened that changed that was Jaws. Jaws came around as a genre picture by one of those film school enfant terribles, you know, and was such a huge blockbuster that they said, oh, this will be our new formula. We'll create 10 blockbusters or wannabe blockbusters, and if we lose money on 9 of them going by that formula, it's okay, because the 10th one will make enough money to make up for the other 9 failures. And that was to become the kind of blueprint for Hollywood for many years to come. Slight change in the 90s, where what happened in the 90s was video stores opened, and all of a sudden there were video stores that needed content. So you could, you know, pre-sell a deal, a domestic deal or a foreign video deal to get just enough money to make an indie film, because they were willing to try, hey, we need a films in here to fill our shelves, you know, so we need more than just 1 or 2 films. So there was a heyday there for indies. And then in the late 80s, 90s, early 90s, and even up to the early 2000s, where, again, risks were being taken, funded risks. And I think the importance is funded, because without any money, and that's a little bit what we're asking of our artists now, it doesn't quite work. You can't quite get the best actors, and you can't quite have enough time to really write the script. You need some money to do it. And the 2 times that I would say are kind of the heydays were the late 80s and 90s and back in the 70s, when in the first case it was the studios funding it. In the 90s it was video deals and DVD deals that were funding it, where it was experimentation but with some resources to do it, you know. And I think that's what we're trying to find again. And I think there's a glimmer of hope in that now with pay-per-view, and to the degree the success of Netflix, there's a little bit of that, you know, but it hasn't come fully realized yet. And right now, you know, you're getting some of your better content in larger series funded by places like Netflix or HBO.
Yeah,
Sorry.
We're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one other question, and I think this sort of ties into what you were just saying. And this is kind of a similar thing with the music industry, you know, because you're a musician too, so you can relate to this, you know, when indie, quote-unquote, indie music was sort of coming around, 80s, 90s or whatever, you know, it meant one thing. And the same with film. And I'm curious, with all the changes you've seen in the industry and stuff, what does indie film mean to you today, and is there still such a thing as quote-unquote indie film the way it used to be?
I think there is, and I think there can. Ryan Coogler's film, Foodville Station, is a pretty good example of it in terms of being, I think, a wonderful, devastatingly good film. But it had the luck of having the mantle taken up by some very powerful people. I went to Occupy Oakland a lot, and I think that you know, film has got to be on some level a call to action for people. There has to be something burning in your soul to make you want to communicate. And with the growing rift between what the, let alone working class, the middle class person can earn or live on, and the very richest people, that's got to be an engine that is fueling something. And it's got to come from passion, and getting it seen is going to be the challenge. There are things like Indiegogo and stuff like that, and I would say, you know, hopefully what gets, I'm hoping that things like Indiegogo don't become another version of the studio where they're only funding actors they've already seen on TV, you know, where they can respond to a project on its merits beyond just more of what they've already seen.
Right.
And I think there's some hope there. Before we end, can I read just a line or two of a couple of friends?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, please do. Please do. I know that you had, there was one friend that you had mentioned, Dan Davidson. Were you going to read something of his?
Yes.
Okay, great. Please do.
Yeah.
If you want to, you want to preface it, go for it.
Yeah. So I'm going to read two things quickly. One is from an existing living writer, who's a friend named Eve Tolliman, and she is on a, you can find some of her writing on a writing blog called As It Ought to Be. And I'm going to read you a quick one of hers called Ankh, by Eve Tolliman. Anna Mokhtova, just the sound of your name softly hammering against the roof of my mouth calls me gently into order. Anna Akhmatova, if one such as you once lived, then I want to live here too. From another world in a smoldering time that formed diamond hearts in a crucible of relentless suffering, you spoke me into being. You left your words dead still on the page that I might find them again, just where you put them. I returned to them shyly, how I dare to resurrect them, dare even touch them when I have not known what you suffered. Yet somehow through the darkness of your time and the bright darkness of mine, your words give me breath, full of the scent of spring and bitter cold iron like blood on my tongue. Because of you, I will breathe deeper and I will risk a little more, your heart and mine, until I take my place beside you under the unknown stones. Okay.
Well,
we have time for one more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But tell me a little bit more about this woman. How do you know her, or how did you know her work?
I know she is a mysterious being, Eve Tolliman. So she goes by two names that I know. And she is a person who has done many things with her life. I'm probably not allowed to disclose the many things she's done, but always writing has been in her soul. Always writing has been in her soul. And this, I want to say this person is not me, definitely not me, this is another person. Writing has been in her soul, and through the internet and this, this blog, that she's one of the writers that is getting her work out there. So that's one of the beautiful changes that has come through the internet and so on. And she is somebody that's done everything you can imagine in terms of, you know, working in the computer industry, working in nonprofits, trying to better the world, and even being a mom. She's done a million different things. And she, when it came time to write, she decided to take on another persona and put herself out in the world that way. So that's on that blog, and I'll just say that again, a site called As It Ought to Be. Now, for in terms of Dan Davidson, do I have time to
preface it a little bit if you want to say something about
I will. I will. So Dan and I were at school together, and we would kind of like, he would win first place in the Academy of America, and I would win second place, and we would bounce off each other. And Dan grew up in a series of foster homes, a very difficult past. He had, you know, put a lot of, he had made forays into punk music, but really was most talented as a writer and somebody we all very much admired. While we were at school, Dan got a flu that wouldn't go away, and he had to have open heart surgery and have his heart valve replaced as a part, which made this perceptible tick. And because of that, he had to, you know, and as I got into, moved away from San Francisco and got into film, I would hear about him from afar, and he had to have a lot of blood transfusions and assault and be on medication as a result of this heart valve. And as a result, developed, you know, one of the bad forms of hepatitis. And I remember I was in town editing Dream of the Fishes. I had shot it, and I was editing it. And it was about, you know, a guy who was trying to take his own life. And I thought, I want to make it a little better before I show Dan because I so highly respected his opinion. And I didn't bring him to the first screening. And in the interim, I learned he had taken his own life because he found it too difficult living with the hepatitis and all of the different medications he was on. And,
wow.
You know, the click that this artificial heart valve made was so loud you could hear it. Especially if he walked up the stairs or was getting excited talking about something. And right around the time of his passing, this book, this sort of magnum opus, was published called Culture. And I'm gonna read two things. I'm gonna read, a little bit, somebody mentioning something about Dan, that somebody wrote me afterward, and then just one of the ending phrases in his book. Let's see if I can find the right thing. Here we go. Dan started. This is an afterword by Gary Sullivan. Dan started Culture in '88 or '89, about a year or so after having had open heart surgery, which is right when I moved to LA. To replace an infected valve. I think the constant ticking of the plastic heart valve, which you could even sometimes hear outdoors amid city noise, gave Dan a real sense of urgency, not to mention a sense of the limits of his own body, and therefore the limits of form in general. He became obsessed with the idea of writing a long, important poem, one that would not only encompass as many aspects of culture as possible, but which would play with and extend ideas to form and artistic production. The first book, Product, was written from his notes taken, as Dan liked to say, in situ, meaning he would sit for hours in various malls and department stores in San Francisco, scribbling furiously in the notebooks, which he seemed to see on and on. Anyway, so that was a little bit from the afterword, and then I'm going to read just, I know we don't have much time, a small part of one of his at the end of Culture.
Good.
Okay, here we go. Culture is, you know, sort of his magnum opus that takes many forms from broken word into prose. And a lot of it's about sort of economic injustice and sort of foresaw a lot of the things to come 10 years later. But here's just the end of it. Life is short, justice long. But time passes whether you're enjoying yourself or not, so you might as well. You'll never be the same again. Time passes the way of sounding sound, hearing about people wanting things, even you. There's gold in these rocks. You can see it layered in the milky quartz. Before the Spanish came, plaster deposits of gold lay in huge swaths along the sandbars of Northern California rivers, washed down from the eons with other sediments from the Sierra Madre. For many thousands of years, this was one of no particular interest to anyone. I suppose I'm speaking about the past, but I never knew what you wanted. I never really understood. Or maybe it was you who didn't understand. I suppose it really doesn't matter now to peacefully leave and never return. I think that would be nice. Only where is there to go? Far enough away for another view, for another reason, too. Once part of the moon slipped from the sky and fell to the earth, as if every memory were enacted, and we would know a thousand different worlds. Where is it that you dissolved, if not divided somewhere between here and who you have become?
That's beautiful. That's Finn Taylor, director-writer Finn Taylor, reading from Culture. And is it Dan Davidson? Is that his name?
Daniel Davidson. Daniel Davidson. Yeah, I called him Dan, I don't know. He didn't like that, but that's what I called him.
Is the book still available?
Yeah, you can find it online. You can buy it in a bookstore, I think through Amazon, and you can also you know, just in the spirit of people actually reading it, you can actually, if you look hard enough, you'll find it online. It's called Culture. It's got kind of an orange cover. And just look up Daniel Davidson Culture, and you'll find it online. I think you can buy it through Amazon and also find it, you know, in a PDF form if for some reason you can't buy it. There you go.
So, Finn, do you have any idea when the Bill Monroe biopic's going
to
be?
Well, we have hopes to be shooting it this fall. We've already actually shot the end credits and recorded the entire soundtrack and cast all the actors, and they're amazing actors. And the music is incredibly, unbelievably good. So we hope to be shooting it in October.
That's great. With me today has been writer-director Finn Taylor. Finn, what's the best way for people to find out about you online?
Gosh, you know, I don't have a website or anything. You can IMDb me or Google me, and there's lots of articles, and you can see what my films are on IMDb. I know there's been a lot of articles and interviews I've done over the years, so
yeah,
that's one way.
Finn, thank you so much for being on the show today. Man, it's been so great to catch up with you.
And Rich, thank you for doing this, and thank you for your beautiful writing and work. I'm always inspired by it.
Well, thank you so much. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thank you to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at WeVoiceSing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be L.A. poet Corey Greathouse. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.